It is a tough and formidable task that confronts the final speaker. All after all that has been said in the last day and a half, one asks the question, is there anything more to say? And I think you will discover that our final presenter is both equal to the task, and yes, there is still much to say. While I could say that I went to high school with Richard John Neuhaus, it should be obvious to the most casual of observers, I cannot say the same about Mr. Robert G. Morrison. I didn't go to high school with him, but I would have liked to if... especially if I would have been so fortunate as to have him for my instructor. Because Mr. Morrison brought to the instructional task, which he conducted in the public schools of our land for some time, the enviable background of a baccalaureate and a master's degree in government and foreign affairs from the University of Virginia, an institution, if my memory serves me correctly, that was founded by no less of a figure than the red-haired 18th century squire who recoined Roger Williams' phrase and introduced the words separation of church and state into both our judicial and ecclesial vocabulary, and both Jefferson and that phrase have been widely misunderstood and abused ever since. That's a personal bias, to be sure. As with many of you, no doubt, my personal acquaintance with the pen of Mr. Morrison resides primarily from the pages of The Reporter, for which he wrote those informative and provocative articles in recent years while serving as the executive director of the Office of Government Information for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in Washington, D.C. Prior to that, he was an educator, a Christian activist. He's taught on the elementary, the junior, and high school levels, and from 1982 to 1984 was the executive director of Connecticut Citizens for Life. In 1984, his expertise was summoned to the United States Department of Education, where he served as a special assistant in research and preparation of documentation and reports on such issues as school prayer, global education, aspects of the emotional and behavioral aspects of our nation's youth. In recent months, he has been continuing his commitment to the task of research and writing, and offers both his background and his insight to our symposium this morning, for which I am personally grateful, and thus it is with both gratitude and with pleasure that I ask you to help me welcome to our symposium Mr. Robert G. Morrison. Very kind.
Dr. Vogel, Dr. Barth, Dr. Wesselschmidt, Pastor Neuhaus, distinguished guests, dear Christian friends, my fellow Indians. And certainly when I left my position with our Missouri Synod office last fall, I wondered would I still, as a former director, would I be able to come and address this symposium? And they said, yes, you can, but you've got to follow Richard Neuhaus. So I thought, well, that was fair. But hearing it this morning, I'm again reminded, and I've got several copies of First Things and some of his excellent writings in my briefcase and along my bookshelves, and I've tried to keep up. I'm a rather slow reader, but it's always reminded me when I hear Dr. Neuhaus that what Thomas Jefferson might have accomplished if he'd only applied himself a bit more. It's also a pleasure to meet again with Bill and Susan Heck. These are people that I've learned to know in Washington, working with our Washington Advisory Council. Susan serves on that for our church body. And I've gained a tremendous amount. Bill is certainly very much the insider in Washington and very, very capable of giving sound advice. I saw pictures in their home at one time. It gave you an idea of how much an insider. There was Bill, and his photograph was inside at the presidential inauguration of 1985. A lot of people usually go to the inauguration of a president, but this was the one, if you recall, was held inside the Capitol Dome because the cold weather forced the first cancellation. There was Bill right inside. Of course, that's not the first one he's been to. He's been to a number of presidential inaugurations. My favorite picture of Bill Heck was the presidential inauguration for Calvin Coolidge. For those of you who don't remember that inauguration, it was Calvin Coolidge became president on the death of President Harding. Mr. Coolidge was up in Vermont vacationing, and his dad was a justice of the peace and swore him in as president with the family Bible and a kerosene lamp. Bill Heck was there. His picture doesn't actually appear. He was out on the porch at the time taking a smoke break, but he is definitely a real insider. Well, many people who work in Washington, we're daily surrounded by reminders of our nation's history, and it does incline you to think of the internal things. Harry Truman, Secretary of State Dean Acheson, titled his memoirs of his turbulent times after World War II in Washington, Present at the Creation. And William Safire wrote of the pre-Watergate Nixon White House in a book called Before the Fall. Most recently, Peggy Noonan, who's a vastly gifted young speechwriter for Presidents Reagan and Bush, she began her book of reminiscences with an arresting image. She surveyed the young idealistic White House aides with whom she worked, and she wrote, "We are the ones who will walk behind Ronald Reagan's caisson." And I thought about that for a moment. I thought, if I were President Reagan, I think I would confound this overeager aide and perhaps opt for burial at sea. But much of my experience of church and state has been gained during the past 6 years in Washington. As mentioned, I served as a special assistant in the Department of Education and also in the Missouri Synod's office. And I worked in that area where we worked primarily with mid-level policy analysts. We were far from the panoply of power and prestige, but it was what might be called the churning level, where a lot of the policy gets hammered out for our country. It was an excellent vantage point. And as a former teacher of government and history, I found it exciting just to be a witness to the important events that were occurring during my time there. The decisions that were being made in my city would have incalculable consequences for millions. My instructions as the first person to serve in this office were from the Synod President of the Missouri Synod, and they were to give a special attention to three areas: life concerns, family matters, and education. This morning, I would like to discuss in some detail, first, the threats to human life that are rapidly increasing in our country; second, the relentless assault on family life that is fueled by Title X of the federal government's program entitled Title X, and then finally, how our Christian community might respond to some of these crises. My first day of service with the Missouri Synod was the day on which President Reagan named Judge Robert Bork to the U.S. Supreme Court. Within a few hours, I had a call from a representative of a mainline Protestant church body asking whether I had been authorized to oppose Bork yet. He invited me to the strategy session being coordinated by Ralph Neese and the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. The only requirement for attendance, I was told, was that the organization you represented was presumed to be against Judge Bork's confirmation. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I had thought that the verdict usually came after the evidence was presented. At any rate, I knew that my days in Washington were going to be interesting ones. Our office did report on that nomination fight. I had the opportunity to write articles for our publications. I tried to provide background reports for our leaders and gave speeches and radio interviews on the issues. I tried to draw people's attention to those enduring issues around which the nomination fight was being fought. The leaders of our church body had determined, and I think quite appropriately, that we should not take a position on the nomination and confirmation of Judge Bork. And this was based on the very reasonable view that the church has no special wisdom to guide it or to guide the state on the selection of federal judges. And I acceded to that position, and I tried not to compromise it. Yet I could not fail to see that Judge Bork was being opposed primarily for his oft-stated view that the Roe versus Wade decision had been wrongly decided. Many Democrats and several key Republicans, namely Weicker, Packwood, and Chafee, had made clear that their opposition, they would oppose any judge who might vote to overturn abortion on demand. And that was something about which our church body was concerned and had taken positions. Judge Bork had criticized the process by which the federal judiciary had created a constitutional right of privacy. This right had been created to arrive at a 1965 decision of the Supreme Court, and that ruling struck down a Connecticut law which prohibited married couples from using contraception. Now, this was a result which most Americans doubtless approved. But the judicially created broad right of privacy was soon used to enact abortion on demand. And it has been used to defend the right of homosexual sodomy, the right to use certain drugs in private, the right of minors to receive contraception without their parents' knowledge, the right to die, even. To many constitutional scholars, this constitutional right of privacy is fundamental to the modern role of government. To others, it is like a constitutional black hole, which threatens to draw into the abyss all other essential liberties. Judge Bork had criticized the aggressive actions of the Supreme Court in overturning state laws. His philosophy of judicial restraint called upon judges to defer to the elected representatives of the American people. Only when laws clearly conflicted with the Constitution, as it was originally understood, should judges strike them down. Without endorsing or questioning this view necessarily, I sought to point out that the states had historically been concerned about such matters as marriage, the care and custody of children, and education. Curbing pornography had largely been a local concern. These were matters in which the people of the church were greatly interested. And these were the very state laws that were being overturned by federal court action. So devastating to the family have key legal rulings of the federal courts been that federal judge John Noonan once asked, "Is the family constitutional?" While the Missouri Synod was practicing a form of ecclesiastical restraint, Washington became the center of a national electronic battleground. Many of the books that have been written about that episode, even by writers who opposed Judge Bork's confirmation, have admitted that the campaign against Robert Bork was marked by unprecedented levels of distortion and character assassination. Lutheran theologian Robert Jensen summed up the campaign against Bork as notable not only for its scurrility, but also for its mendacity. We should also be aware that millions of dollars that were raised by groups which opposed Judge Bork had become part of a vast war chest, and that that war chest is today being used in battlefields in such states, or in legislative battles in such states as Idaho. Judge Bork has referred to that episode in our nation's history as the Bloody Crossroads, that fateful juncture where the law and politics meet. Now, I think there's a great irony in the Bork battle. All the pro-life groups and many of the pro-life church bodies tried to secure his confirmation. But Robert Bork said then, and he has repeated since, that the Constitution is silent on abortion. He was described by his close friend George Will as a judge who is, quote, unalterably in favor of a legislature's right to legalize abortion, unquote. Judge Bork said during his nomination fight that he had not thought out his own view of abortion. Well, for a constitutional lawyer, I thought this was a curious attitude. For a nominee for the bench, I could certainly understand it, but I found it a little bit intellectually unsatisfying. I thought it would be a little bit like Sir Edmund Hillary after conquering K2 or Mount Kilimanjaro saying to reporters he hadn't quite thought out his view on Everest. But the Constitution is also silent on lynching, and yet we may assume that the framers would have taken a dim view of state legislatures which withdrew the protection of their laws from murders committed against black people. Judge Bork criticized the Roe Court for striking down the laws of 50 states on abortion without explicit constitutional warrant. But the court in Roe did more than that. It declared that unborn human beings are not entitled to the protection that law gives to persons. And this removal of an entire class of human beings from the protection of the law cannot, I suggest, and will not be limited to unborn children. The Supreme Court is even now considering the Cruzan case. And depending on how the court rules, it may become permissible to take direct action to cause death. In short, killing. More quietly than in the abortion cases, state after state withdrew the protection of the law from cases of suicide and attempted suicide during the 60s and 70s. I say protection of the law because I believe that the law is like the guardrail on the mountain highways of life. True, we may be confined by it, and we may feel restricted. Some of us may even collide with it. But the purpose of the guardrail is to prevent society from going over the cliff. And when I served in the Department of Education, I was stunned to read scholarly papers in which it was presented and argued at psychological conferences that teenagers had a privacy right based on personal autonomy to commit suicide. Autonomy is at the heart of the constitutional philosophy of Professor Lawrence Tribe of Harvard University. Professor Tribe was Judge Bork's most eloquent critic. I believe that the Constitution implicitly and explicitly protects life. An original understanding of the term person would never have allowed it to be divorced from human being. The right to life did not receive its first expression in the Constitution or in the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson said the care of human life and happiness, and not their destruction, is the first and only legitimate object of good government. And this was not a novel or unique view or some Jeffersonian concept. It was a commonly held view in the generation that wrote the Declaration and the Constitution. Political theorists for hundreds of years had recognized it as the first among rights, and it has been accurately described as the right to have rights. At a time when we hear much press discussion of human rights, both in our country and other countries, it's always been interesting to me that that category almost never includes the right of humans to survive long enough to claim their rights. Another of the many ironies to be found in the Roe versus Wade decision is the reliance on the judicially created right of privacy. That concept was originally advanced in an article entitled The Right to Privacy, written by Harvard Law professor Louis D. Brandeis. That article appeared in 1890 in the Harvard Law Review. Brandeis, of course, was later a Supreme Court justice. And he wrote that the right to privacy was one of the fundamental rights, like the right to be free from bodily injury and the right to hold property. And these rights were fundamental, Brandeis said, because they emanated from the right to life. Further, the Supreme Court in Roe created a new life form hitherto unknown in law, in political theory, and in medicine. The court majority called it potential human life. And as Pastor Newhouse has said it and formulated it, he's exposed the lethal illogic that the court put into our law. Pastor Newhouse said, "Nothing that is not human life has the potential for being human life. Nothing that has the potential for being human life is not human life." Judge Bork has further distanced himself from some of his enthusiastic supporters by saying that, unlike slavery, the abortion question does not threaten the life of this nation. I'm not sure. Lincoln compared slavery to a growing tumor. He understood these fundamental questions. Our country is based on a broad and tolerant political community, but there are and must be some limits to what is tolerated. Democracy, they say, is based on the belief that it is better to count heads than bash them. But there are organizations who are dedicated to bashing heads before they can be counted. Abortion is not only the slaying of an unborn child, it is a radical attack on the political philosophy of the United States of America. To accept abortion, we must reject the view expressed in the Declaration that we are created equal and that our Creator endows us with rights that are inalienable. The abortion advocates will not stop with the choice of abortion legally secured. They have demanded and will always demand that each of us pay for these killings with our taxes. They have demanded and will continue to demand that hospitals, even church-run hospitals, colleges, and schools should provide for abortion. And the theorists of abortion have argued coherently for a woman's right to sell her unborn child's organs. And further, they say that it is an infringement on that constitutionally protected zone of privacy to prevent contracts being signed that would lead to the conception, killing, and sale of human beings. The theorists must break down all legal and ethical barriers to the sale of what they call the products of conception. And in the 21st century, we may see a worldwide market in body parts that are created by insatiable demands of increasingly senescent and decadent societies. Scholars writing in prestigious papers like the Wall Street Journal have argued that the 1.5 million toll that we currently have may not be enough to sustain the burgeoning biotech industry. We may need 3 million abortions a year. I think Lincoln would have recognized the scene being prepared for us. The props are all there. The script has been written. The main actors enter from the wing, and at stage center is the human auction block. Lincoln knew the importance of the drama. He told an audience in Hartford in 1860, "I think one great mistake is made by them all. I think our wisest men have made this mistake. They underrate its importance, and the settlement can never be effected until its magnitude is properly estimated. Those who own slaves look upon them as property and nothing else. They contemplate them as property and speak of them as such." Lincoln marshaled the people of the North and West not only in opposition to the moral evil of slavery, but to the defense of Republican values themselves. He did not hold out his party as a big tent in which all points of view were welcome and morally equivalent. He said, "Believing it right as they do, they are not to blame for seeking its full recognition as being right. But believing it wrong as we do, shall we give our votes to their view and against our own? What we want," he said, "and all we want, is to have with us those who think that slavery is wrong." In his time, as in ours, there were politicians eager to say that they were personally opposed to the wrong, but would do nothing politically to stop its spread. They were governors. They were senators. And Lincoln said, "Those who say they hate slavery and that they are opposed to it, where are they? Let us apply a few tests. You say you think it is wrong, but you denounce all attempts to restrain it. Is there anything else that you think wrong that you're unwilling to deal with as a wrong? Why are you so careful, so tender, of this one wrong and no other? You will not let us do a single thing as if it was wrong. There is no place where you will even allow it to be called wrong. We must not call it wrong in politics, because that is bringing morality into politics. And we must not call it wrong in the pulpit, because that is bringing politics into religion. According to you, there is no single place where this wrong thing can properly be called wrong." Well, today the lines are not so clear-cut. While our Democratic Party, founded by Thomas Jefferson, is officially committed to abortion on demand, leading Republicans are backing away from their party platform commitments of three national campaigns, three victorious campaigns. Fred Barnes, the editor of the New Republic and a sympathetic evangelical, has said that the pro-life movement is losing the political struggle. And he says this is so because many politicians were eager to have the quiet support of pro-life groups and voters, but never bothered to learn why they should be pro-life. Barnes cites a lengthening list of prominent politicians who have backed away from their stands. All the pressure, he says, is being felt in the Republican Party. Pro-life Democrats, and there are many of them, were briskly rebuffed by Party Chairman Ron Brown when they asked that the party simply reconsider its extremist position. Part of the problem, I think, is our tendency to talk about issues. We have accepted a media-driven, media-derived definition of the public agenda. Because the press gets bored talking about one thing, it assumes that the public is similarly bored. But history has often turned on one thing: the just shall live by faith alone. No taxation without representation. A house divided against itself cannot stand. Under the constant scrutiny of the media, we give little attention to a lot of diverse matters. We go into no matter with any real depth. We are shown few connections. No coherent philosophy of life or government is allowed to emerge. And those who seek to provide a sense of priority are dismissed as single-issue zealots or hopelessly naive. The pro-life argument in abortion is nothing more than a restatement of classical Western political theory. And that theory reflected Christian values. The abandonment of these theories, therefore, will not just lead to, as it has led to, killing of millions of unborn children, but to the subversion of the political basis of the American Republic itself. When President Reagan termed the Soviet Union an evil empire several years ago, he was immediately attacked by some journalists and by many political leaders for self-righteousness. He was being too judgmental, they said. And yet that statement struck a responsive chord in the Soviet Union itself and in the captive nations. Today, we see in the desperate reform efforts of thousands in Russia and in Eastern Europe the poignant desire to live in a normal country, one that is governed by the rule of law. Even Gorbachev's stated desire to bring the Soviet Union under the rule of law and his avoidance of force in quelling the uprisings in Eastern Europe, we see a tacit admission that the Soviets ruled an empire and that there was something intrinsically wrong in it. But Russia is not, I would suggest, as President Reagan said, the focus of evil. And I think that's consistent with our Lutheran theology. It is not the focus of evil. Throughout the last 20 years, and even during the 8 years of the Reagan presidency, Congress has authorized the payment of billions of dollars to Planned Parenthood and its allies. And this is an organization that I think can be characterized as an evil enterprise. For Planned Parenthood is responsible directly for over 85,000 killings a year in the United States, and indirectly for hundreds of thousands more. But when it is not directly performing abortions, suing government about abortion, or threatening politicians in expensive media campaigns, they are busy providing contraceptives and sexually seductive indoctrination to businessmen, to public and private school teachers, to college students, poor people, and children. Everywhere, this subtle and sophisticated conspiracy works to undermine marriage and family. It teaches that chastity is but an option among equally valid options. Usually the pamphlets and brochures that concede that it's okay to say no are cited by Planned Parenthood's skilled agents only when they come under fire from parents groups or legislators because Planned Parenthood is undermining traditional moral beliefs. But when dealing directly with young people, they are far more likely to tell them, don't let anyone cheat you out of an orgasm. Or, it's all right to choose from among numerous sexual partners. It should not surprise us, therefore, that every venereal disease, according to the Centers for Disease Control, every venereal disease is out of control in the United States today. The same people who once argued that federally funded birth control clinics were the best way to avoid abortion now use the federal monies to support an infrastructure which promotes it. Planned Parenthood alone receives the lion's share of over $140 million in federal family planning funds each year. And by comparison, our Synod's budget is about $140 million. Our church body has sought to counter this threat by active support of programs like Title 20, which is the Adolescent and Family Life Act. This was passed in 1981, and it stresses abstinence and adoption. But that program never gained a fraction of the monies that were dedicated to the Title 10 program. And even at that, Planned Parenthood's allies in and out of Congress have relentlessly attacked Title 20, harassing it through the courts, undermining its effectiveness. Even now, legislation sponsored by Senator Kennedy, co-sponsored by Senator Simon, would gut Title 20 and make it into a clone of Title 10. There has been misunderstanding, I think, about Title 10. We in the Missouri Synod have taught that Christians may use artificial contraception within the context of marriage. Like many Protestants, we have recognized the laxity of spacing births. But the Protestant view has been widely interpreted in Washington as a blanket approval for the federal government to distribute and dispense contraceptive devices to unmarried couples. Many pro-life groups have strong representation from the Roman Catholic community, and they are understandably sensitive to the charge that they might seek to impose Catholic moral teaching on the entire nation. So many of these pro-life leaders have bent over backward to avoid attacking Title 10. But we are seeing that that is some of the basis for the very problem that we've encountered in our society, the rise of out-of-wedlock pregnancy. One of these pro-life leaders joked in a background meeting that I attended that President Reagan was so dependent on his cue cards, his index cards, that he came into a meeting and referred to Title 10 as Title X. Well, as I started looking at Title 10, I think the president had it more correctly. I think it more accurately should be described as Title X, because it has given the full weight and moral authority of the greatest government on earth to a patently immoral lifestyle. When the Reagan administration attempted the most modest reforms of Title 10, Planned Parenthood screamed foul and successfully sued the federal government. And the reform? Simply that parents should be told when their minor children had received contraceptives from their own government. The administration did not even propose that parents be allowed to veto that decision, but merely that they be informed of what their government had done with their children. Journalist, one of the journalists in Washington, and there are not many sympathetic ears on this, but one journalist in Washington said that he didn't agree with the evangelicals, he didn't agree with the Christians on many issues. He said, but on this one issue, he said, it was all one way in the press. He said, except with me. He said, I have a 16-year-old daughter. So I think there's a hopeful sign there. But the reasons for Title X's failures are many, not the least of which are reasons cited by former U.S. Surgeon General Koop and Washington Post reporter Leon Dash. Dr. Koop told an interviewer recently that teenagers were poor contraceptors because they are natural risk takers. They do not heed the warnings about death and disease because they see themselves as immortal. Dr. Koop suggested that they be taught traditional moral values about sex and marriage. This interview was granted a year after the spotlight was off Dr. Koop's somewhat public pulpit, and the interviewer quickly changed the subject. Leon Dash went into the heart of Southeast Washington, D.C., and this is the same community that is beset by drug murders today that we read about. This is the same community where young people are becoming pregnant out of wedlock at an enormous rate. Mr. Dash is a sophisticated black journalist for the Washington Post. He wrote that he had expected to find teenagers in that community who simply did not know how to avoid getting pregnant and bearing children out of wedlock. What he found instead was that many of the young girls seek out pregnancy as a way to have hope and the love of children in their lives. And the young men are often glad to oblige because they see fathering a child as a sign of manhood. But an inescapable attitude underlines all of Planned Parenthood's programs, and that attitude is contempt for parents. Parents fail to teach their children about sex, we are told. Parents are likely to abuse their children if they learn that the children are engaged, the young people are engaged in illicit sex. Parents want to deny their children the pleasures of physical intimacy. This is Planned Parenthood's unremitting assault on the dignity and status of parents. It cannot help but be reflected in our attitude toward the elderly. Most older people are depicted in the mass media as either self-indulgent hedonists or fools. They're shown nearer to death, but no nearer to God. It is small wonder, then, that many are concluding that it would be better to ease them on their way, and the constitutional skids have been greased. With autonomy on their banners, many groups are forming to speed the demise of the elderly. The Washington Post weighed in this week with a sympathetic portrayal of the common practice in the Netherlands of poisoning the old. The safeguards are all there, of course, the Post assures us. The Post urges us to go Dutch. Why is it then that so many elderly people in Holland are afraid to go to the hospital? The coming census will show this to be a rapidly aging society. The number of adults aged 25 to 34 is expected to drop from 44 million this year to 37 million by the year 2000. The ratio of working age taxpayers to elderly people will shrink from 5 to 1 today to 2.5 to 1 in the year 2030. At current projections. Social Security and Medicare have already become the largest component of the federal budget. And the tax pressures on the young adult group are being ratcheted up once again. The House of Representatives this week passed an ambitious new program of institutionalized, centralized, secularized daycare for children. And this program will further attenuate the strained bonds of family life. It will replace one of the most respected roles of grandparents. Once we have decided that unborn children with all their potential for society are dispensable, we will see the elderly moved into the killing fields without too much fuss. Many of them will go willingly for reasons that are altruistic if misguided. The New England Journal of Medicine is poised to usher them out, and that Prestige Press will continue to trumpet euthanasia's gentle ending. And what I've sketched out this morning seems a darkened landscape, and the picture is very ominous in many ways. But most speakers are expected to sound a call to arms when they've told their listeners that the barbarians are at the gates. But the barbarians are not at the gates. The barbarians are in the city. They occupy some of the highest seats of power in the press, in academia, in medical and legal professions, and in government. There are practical things, though, that I think we can do. Our church body, for example, can appeal to the American Bar Association to reverse its recent decision to endorse Roe versus Wade. And if the ABA refuses, we could join with others to ask the Justice Department to withdraw the privilege that the ABA has abused of reviewing federal judicial nominees, since they are now a party to the dispute. Our church body could appeal to organized labor not to endorse Roe. If the AFL-CIO refuses, we could inform Lutheran Union members that they have rights to withhold a portion of their dues from political activities which they find morally objectionable. We can authorize our excellent Commission on Organizations to publish a thorough analysis of the activities of Planned Parenthood so that every pastor and layperson can know in detail what this organization does. We can authorize the Missouri Synod members on the Committee on Lutheran Cooperation to intercede with the ELCA members of that committee. Our members could plead for the lives of handicapped unborn children at Lutheran General Hospital in Chicago. These children are being killed daily at this hospital under the sign of the cross. But if after consideration our church body decides that these are not the things that are appropriate for us to do, there are still many, many things that we can do. We can serve well by speaking the truth. We've heard in our discussions in the last 2 days of many famous politicians. I'd like to offer to you two names that are not famous. Senator Chukwa is a Democrat, and Senator Bambakas is a Republican. Those are names that might almost be coming to us out of the news of Eastern Europe. But they're not from Eastern Europe. They're in our state senate in Maryland. They were among 16 state senators who stood up to resist a renewed assault on the sanctity of human life. For 8 days, they held off an organized media barrage. Now, Senator Chukwa wanted to be appointed to the State Public Service Commission. He won't be. Senator Bambakas wanted an art center for his impoverished mountain district. He won't get it. But Senators Chukwa and Bambakas and their 14 colleagues have been targeted for defeat, and many of them doubtless will be defeated, for there is very little support for their view in my state of Maryland. But I think we can, as Christians, thank them for their courage. We can pray for them. We can communicate with them. We can give them the kind of encouragement that we too infrequently give. Senator Bambakas told the Washington Times he would rather die than consent to the new attack on the undefended. But speaking truth to power has always been the duty of the church. It is more necessary now than ever, especially when every other institution, it seems, has gone astray. For as Alexander Solzhenitsyn said in his Nobel Prize lecture, one word of truth can move the world. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, if anybody wants to tackle that, the same rules will apply at the microphones. It would be considered a courtesy and helpful to the process if your comments were phrased in the interrogative, but you're welcome to Mr. Morrison welcomes your questions and will respond in order. Yes, sir.
Does Paul Simon still have a pro-choice position?
Unquestionably so. In fact, I think that's probably going much further than it might have been before. He's been through a presidential campaign. He knows certainly how those campaigns are financed. In the state of New York, where I'm from, in 1988, Senator Gore was the only candidate for president in his party who attempted in any way to restrain the complete philosophy that goes with that point of view. He said that he thought perhaps we oughtn't to require the many citizens who disagreed with this to pay for it through their tax dollars. Senator Gore had audible groans of his audience, and his support in the polls went from 20-25% down to 10%. The lesson was not lost on other politicians. What we have to see is, in this dichotomy of Swedes and Indians, the Swedes certainly have the PACs, and that's where the support goes.
Skip, I have someone waiting to take me to the airport right now, but I wanted to say, and this is indicative rather than interrogative, so I violate your rule here. Because several people said to me, they said, you know, Morrison's in there saying that the church should do all the things that you said the church shouldn't do. And that would be a great confusion if anybody interpreted it that way. I think that on the questions of the dignity of human life and of our God-given responsibilities of stewardship for the vulnerable, that for a church body to have clearly thought through in a theological way the groundings of the protest which in the name of God we raise on behalf of the creatures of God, that is a perfectly legitimate, not only legitimate, but imperative role for a church to play. And the Missouri Synod, along with many of our evangelical friends and the Roman Catholic leadership in this country, are all to be, I think, warmly commended, encouraged, and their efforts backed up with our active support on what is a major assault in precisely what I said earlier relative to the Barman Declaration, is the church's proper role of saying no against the clear, barbaric denial of God's teaching with regard to the right ordering of the civil realm. This does not involve the church necessarily in saying how this problem is going to be resolved. That is, our role is to bear witness as vigorously and effectively as we can to what we believe to be an alternative to a thoroughly pagan and indeed sub-pagan understanding of the left-hand will of God. So there's no, at least I didn't hear everything that Bob said, but I heard the last 20 minutes, and as far as I can see in knowing Bob over the years, there's no conflict, although there are a lot of detailed discussions one would have about that fine line between the witness that is a protest against manifest evil and the church's role in pointing out alternatives to it. And that will always remain an area of ambiguity. But I find myself in full support and agreement with Bob Morrison's courageous witness. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. As they say in my mother's part of the world, let the church say amen. And if anybody thinks those comments were brand new insights on the part of Richard John Newhouse, they haven't been listening to him very carefully for many years. I appreciate that very much. Yes, sir.
Yes. As last speaker, and with your list of qualifications, including education, would you not add to that list that you made at the end so eloquently? Our schools, both at the elementary level and high school level, as really being our major weapon right now, since it is a political realm, that the educated voter with the religious background has now got to be our sword?
Yeah, I kept finding it very, very curious as to where had we lost the train? Why was it that I never went to a Christian school at any level, from elementary school all the way through graduate school, and so I found it astonishing when these commonly held understandings were being lost in our own time. And you find that within the church, that is where you continue to hold the civilizing influence of 2,000 years. So I think our Christian schools, both run by our Missouri Synod and by many of the other Christian communities, are vitally important, which is something that will be affected clearly by the daycare bill that is being proposed, and by other things, too, that seem not immediately to be directly related to a church and state question, something like the asbestos regulations, seemingly just a routine kind of housekeeping measure, but nonetheless, which can have the impact of, through regulation, through an indirect taxation, forcing out these independent voices.
My question has to do with the daycare bill that was just passed in the House. Will it pass as it, I know it was close in the House, will it pass easily in the Senate, and will the President veto it, and what is the impact on the church?
Well, the President has said that he would veto the ABC bill, and the House version is apparently even less desirable to the Christian community than the ABC bill was, which came from the Senate. So the President has taken that position. Now, what will happen, it's very unlikely when they get together the House and Senate conference committees that they will make the bill better than the ABC bill. This is a hard one because in some ways it appears in the text of the bill that some of our concerns have been accommodated. And we often look at it as an institution. Will our Missouri Synod Early Childhood Education Centers be affected? Will we be able to participate? Is this fair to us and to others who run church-related daycare centers? But while I was in the office, I tried to argue that we have families in our church body that are also an institution, which are very important. Families will be subjected to disproportionate pressures. Now, you have a system of incentives and disincentives. In short, if you care for your own children or if a member, family member cares for your children, if you select a relative or a close friend or neighbor, a member of your congregation to care for your children part-time or full-time, these people will come under increasing regulation and financial pressures, essentially being thrust upon them by federal action. Now, there is a real problem, single parenthood. There is a real problem of people who are impoverished and who need to find affordable and quality daycare. But I think it's a fair question to begin to ask, what in federal family policy in the past 25 years is there to suggest that further centralization, secularization, and bureaucratization is the answer to that problem? I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, the recent turn of events in Idaho and other places in terms of the pro-life battle are not encouraging. And I know and it seems like the pro-choice groups are much better organized, they have a much greater fervor, and they seem to be winning out. And I know we can state all the standard reasons for that. They have more money, but the pro-lifers have always done very well with less money. The media is against them and siding with the other side and skewing it, true, but they've always done that.
Right.
The politicians,
1839, by the way.
Yeah.
Since 1839.
Sure. And the politicians are going with the polls, and the polls are always asked in such a way as to make the other side look like they're more numerous, and they're really not. We can say all that, but it seems to me, why aren't the pro-lifers out there in greater numbers? Why aren't they reacting more to this? Why aren't they making a better presence in all these state battles?
Well, first of all, there have been some victories in Pennsylvania, for example, and a number of legislative contests. These tend not to be reported. We tend to get most of our news, even we in the Christian community, most of our news we tend to get from secular sources. USA Today, there is probably no more staunch advocate on the pro-abortion side than USA Today. But the thing to remember, too, is that politicians are aware that the intensity is there, certainly, on the other side, an intensity that is born of people who've made some pretty desperate commitments in their lives to how they want to live their lives. And this is the focus. This is the focal point for them. They are militant and they're threatening. They're aggressive. They're saying, we are going to take you out of office. We have the money to do it. We have a whole host of organizations that are supportive of our agenda, and we're going to take you out of public office if you go along with this. And they will do it. The hopeful sign, I need to give signs of hope in here, is that I remember, and Pastor Newhouse knows this better than most, that in my lifetime, I can remember members of the United States Senate and Congress and the House of Representatives who were avowed segregationists, who really argued in the floor of the U.S. Senate that it was better for the races to be kept separate by force of law. But what happened in the 60s, one of the best moments for the church, I would suggest, is that the Christian community came together, especially at the time when we were about to pass the Civil Rights Bill. The Christian community said that racial segregation is a great moral issue. And I think that witness of Christians helped to convince politicians on all sides that they, having lost the fight in the Senate, that they should then go with with the enfranchisement and empowerment of people who had been left out of American life. Now, that's a very positive sign of what the church could do in this area. It's not a question of, you don't know how that worked out in a partisan way, but it was just, it's a very good sign the United States got past that time in our history with a, as we look back on it now, they were turbulent days, but still, when you think of what might have happened with desegregation, what might have happened to permanent divisions in our society, I had hoped that the same kind of thing would happen. I worked with the Catholic bishops in Connecticut. I hoped that you would see from the Roman Catholic community, the Lutheran community, the evangelical community, an agreement at least on this much, that, as Lincoln would say, we cannot be responsible for the views of others, but we will at least hold to our own view. And those who seek to represent us and our people in government must show that they understand what government's for. And at least we will have that much priority given to the fact that government is not about the business of destroying its future citizens. So I think that's part of the question. Is it appropriate to place a priority on this? I think many of you have been bludgeoned with the priority that's been placed on this. But I think it is appropriate to place a priority, just as it was in the 60s, to say it's really not acceptable to us that you are a senator and you are going to continue to vote to segregate black people.
As Mr. Morrison and I leave the stage, I would ask you to once again express your appreciation to Mr. Morrison, but also to the chairman of the symposium, Dr. Quentin Wesselschmidt, who will be coming to the stage to dismiss us. Thank you.